These days when I think of my good friend Uncle Abi Dawji, I think of that hadith of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, which encourages us to be kind to the elderly, especially those who are frail, those who get sick on a fairly regular basis, those who opt out of programs on flimsical excuses. It's all got to do with age. Uncle Abi, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I don't like that preamble, Maulana.
Nobody likes to face up to the reality of old age now, do they?
Well, I just came out of the gym now, last 2 hours, so I don't know who you're talking about.
Yeah, old people have so much of time on their hands that they have to go and spend it somewhere. But anyway, story that caught your eye this week.
Maulana, you're incorrigible, whatever that word means. Dear listeners, as you all know very well, Donald Trump is my main man. Eh? Without him, this program would be called The Small Picture. Now, President Pagla provides material every week, far overtaking the other Dunson, that is George Bush, ever did. One stupid statement, one blunder after another. Well, Donald just signed a new law imposing sanctions, more sanctions on Russia. And after signing it, he announced, this is a very bad law. It is completely flawed. So, why did you sign it, eh, Mampara? And I just heard yesterday, Donald was discussing the war in Afghanistan with his close advisors. The meeting lasted 2 hours. The president was all fed up and he said, we are not winning. Listen to this. According to one official, Trump at one point said the situation in Afghanistan was similar to renovations that occurred at his 21 Club, one of the best restaurants in New York City that he owned. Mm. In the 1980s, the elite New York City hotspot closed and hired an expensive consultant to craft a plan for a renovation. After a year, Trump said to his advisors there in the White House, he said, after a year, the consultant's only suggestion was that the restaurant needed a bigger kitchen. So the message that he was giving to his advisors, his top military guys, three-star generals, was that they are useless. It's no wonder that one by one, staff at the White House are jumping ship. Sean Spicer, the White House spokesperson, left. Reince Priebus, the chief of staff, top man there, he left a few days ago, and another spokesperson took over there, Anthony Scaramucci, and he got the bullet. He only lasted for 10 days, and he was escorted out of the White House. And the news just came out about Donald's conversation with President of Mexico. He had this conversation on the phone a few months ago, and so this has leaked out. And Donald told him, hey, Mamu, shut up, okay? Stop objecting to the wall that I'm going to build because the U.S., between the U.S. and Mexico, okay? So please, just shut up. Wow, that is so presidential, eh? If you think he is an idiot, you should check out his son-in-law, actually, Jared Kushner. It's a real circus at the White House. Actually, it's like Disneyland, Donald and Goofy. That is Goofy Kushner. Is Donald Trump's chief advisor and mediator on the Israeli-Palestinian problem. Did you hear that, eh? The chief mediator. His family, Kushner's family, and Netanyahu are family friends since he was a child, so very likely Netanyahu was carrying him at that time. He is the chief negotiator between the Israelis and the Palestinians. And recently, he gave a lecture to a group of interns, that is congressional interns. And during the question time, question and answer session, he was asked, so what can the U.S. do to solve the Middle East problem? And what was his answer? I don't know. It's a real circus. Can you believe it? Eh? Actually, there is a word that is now in the dictionary, and I mentioned it a few months ago, which actually describes the government of Donald J. Trump. And yesterday I read an article in which the author says this, Donald J. Trump as president and with his bizarre antics during the last 6 months causing puzzled stunned amazement around the world. Perhaps the best description of his government is that it is a khakistocracy. Khakistocracy. It's actually a word. And according to, well, let me just give you a definition. Khakistocracy, first definition, a state or country run by the worst, least qualified or most unscrupulous citizens. This is from Wikipedia. Number two, government by the worst person, a form of government in which the worst person are in power. That's from dictionary.com. And the third definition, government by the least qualified, most stupid members. And this is amaroyli.com. So, dear listeners, by this definition, can we say that that South Africa is a khakistocracy? Mm. My answer to that is, you know what? I don't know why I got talking about Donald Trump when I should be speaking about the story that caught my eye. Ah, yes, now I remember. Donald Trump is my chummy. I want to announce right now, dear listeners, that I also have a new buddy. New chummy. Mm. He's also quite a character, and I predict that he's going to give me quite a lot of material for this program. He's young and vibrant, a really exciting fellow. And I'm speaking about Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Actually, one could call him the king of Saudi Arabia because his body is completely in the background, irrelevant. The lighty is actually running the show. What a guy, what a guy. People say that he's a liberal. Well, I just got some amazing news for you, dear listeners. Really, really amazing. Some may call it shocking. Prince Mohammed bin Salman has just announced a major, major, major project for Saudi Arabia. He looked across the border into Dubai and thought, wow, they are really doing very well. And tourists are flocking in and pouring in billions of dollars, fabulous hotels, great beaches and so on. So Salman Bhai decided, well, if they can do it, why can't I? And so, ladies and gentlemen, I just read in the British Telegraph newspaper that soon new luxury resorts will spring up in Saudi Arabia and most tourists won't even require a visa. And are you ready for this? Ladies in bikinis will be a common sight, eh? Sure. Saudi Arabia, the new Dubai, can you believe it, eh? You think I'm making it all up, don't you? Well, let me tell you that it's been reported in many newspapers, including the Saudi newspapers, Arab News and Saudi Gazette. So it's true, eh? But let me make this story a little bit clearer. There are 50 small islands off the northwest coast of Saudi Arabia belonging to, they belong to Saudi Arabia. Salman announced on Monday that the project to build 5-star resorts on these islands will begin in 2019 and completed by 2022. The world's top hotel groups will be invited to construct the hotels there. So expect the Hiltons, the Marriott, the Intercontinentals, the Hyatt, the Four Seasons, all will be there. Of course, you will also have the Trump Towers of Saudi Arabia. Salman Bhai is head of the Saudi Public Investment Fund. The fund presently has $183 billion. That's what it's got in the kitty. And next year it's going to get many, many billions more when the Saudi oil company, Saudi Aramco, sells its shares on the international stock market. With the bottom dropping out of the oil prices, Salman thought that going the way of Dubai will be a good investment. People from all over the world will be able to fly directly onto special airports built at these resorts. And here's the important part. The resorts will be, in the words of the launch brochure, these are the words, governed by laws on par with international standards. Wow, eh? Governed by laws on par with international standards. That means like in Miami, on the beaches in Miami, or San Tropez, or Ibiza, or Copacabana Beach, eh? Or Cape Town Sandy Beach. Translate that to mean lowering of gazes will be a big problem. Did you ever think, dear listeners, did you ever think that you would ever say the word Saudi Arabia and bikini in the same sentence? Eh? Make dua for Brother Salman. Okay, still on the subject of religion, Maulana.
Mm.
Still on the subject of religion. It's Friday today. We have to talk about holy things. The Middle East is full of fast food places. Eh? Hardee's and Popeye and Burger King, KFC and so on. And most have drive-through. The drive-through facility. You drive your car up to the window and you collect and pay and move on. Just like we have here in Johannesburg and Durban. Fast food on the go. No time to waste. Well, dear listeners, there is a brand new service that has just been launched, just been announced. A fatwa on the move.
Yeah?
Yes, yeah. Instant fatwa. And you are wondering what I'm smoking, eh? Well, here's a report from the Guardian newspaper. It's also reported in the Al Bawaba, an Egyptian news site. It says here, Sheikh from Egypt's highest Islamic authority have opened a fatwa kiosk in the Cairo Metro rail station to offer religious advice to commuters in what they say is an effort to counter extremism. According to Al-Azhar, Al-Azhar al-Sharif, Egypt's top Islamic body, which installs the booth, the project is intended to correct misinterpretations of Islam. So, dear listeners, in a fatwa booth or stall, you can see, you can go onto the website and just put the words in fatwa or stalls and Cairo Metro, and you will see pictures of these stalls. You will see the fatwa on the go stalls. As I was saying, in each of these fatwa stalls, there are two Maulanas, eh? Two Maulanas sitting there. They work from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. and the next shift is from 2 a.m. to 8 p.m. The fatwa kiosks have been running for just over a week and already it's been declared a huge success. On the first day alone, it had 142 visitors. And in the past 8 days, 1,500 questions were asked. And hear this, Maulana, hear this.
Mm.
Al Monitor news site spoke to one of the sheikhs in the booth, Sheikh Ahmed Ramzi, who said this, the response from the public has been overwhelming. There is a real hunger for knowledge about the religious matters. Now, he's dressed in his Islamic dress, the kurta, and Ramzi consulted with his colleague Sheikh Ali Mustafa before responding to a question from 18-year-old Haga Saleh. Haga Saleh, a veiled, wearing a niqab, a traveler, a commuter in the station, about what Sharia says about practicing taekwondo in a mixed venue. Taekwondo, that is some self-defense thing. The Sheikh asked her, does the sport involve physical contact with the opposite sex? If not, then it is fine, he said. But quickly he warned, as long as you wear a loose sports outfit that does not show your body. After hearing the fatwa, Hagar walked away to catch a train approaching the station, clearly relieved that the sheikh had told her she could continue to practice the sport she enjoys. Ish, Maulana, I wonder what our Maulvis will think of that fatwa, eh? And what about if a comedian was telling religious stories while these people were practicing self-defense, eh? But I just got a brilliant idea, Maulana.
Yeah.
How about following this idea from Al-Azhar? Why don't you set up a booth at Park Station in Johannesburg, eh? I can just imagine you there, sitting in there dishing out fatwas like Kentucky wings and nuggets. You know, I'll be the first one to come up to you, to that large, you'll have to have a very large kiosk, and ask you the question that someone actually posted somewhere, and asked the Maulana, is your salah accepted if you made it on a stolen musalla? That's a terrible one, right?
Yeah.
One piece of advice, Maulana.
Hmm.
If you will be doing night shift, eh, please don't wear your shiny black kurta. Otherwise, you look like a booth inside the fatwa booth.
Yeah, I thought you said you're going to ask me the first question about head transplant, but anyway. You haven't spoken about Afghanistan for a very long time.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, the United States has been waging war in Afghanistan for the past 17 years, eh? 17 years. Can you believe it? Does anyone know why? Well, it happened immediately, the invasion of Afghanistan, immediately after 9/11, when the planes went into the Twin Towers. We were told that 19 Arab hijackers did it, most of them from Saudi Arabia. So one would expect that America would attack Saudi Arabia. Yes? Well, don't be silly, eh? George Bush and the Saudi king were like cousin brothers and all, as we say in Durban. So why attack Afghanistan? Ah, yes. Osama bin Laden was there, protected by the Taliban. And the U.S. said that he planned the whole 9/11 thing in his cave in Tora Bora. And Sheriff George Bush said, hand him over or we're going to come there and get you. And the Taliban said, the Pashtun equivalent of Futsak, give us proof that he did it. And Sheriff George Bush said, okay, that's it. I'm coming over with my posse to Kandahar to kick your butt. You ain't going to find no place to hide. I'm going to smoke you out. Well, 17 years later, and the Taliban is still there. It was going to be a quick war, maybe 6 months, maybe 1 year. Well, they are still there, and there are 8,400 U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Did you know that they are still there? 8,400 U.S. troops, eh? And guess how much the war has cost the United States so far? And the answer is $700 billion. Sure, that's a lot of money spent to kick out a rough band of Kurtawalas. John Shopko is the Inspector General for Afghanistan's reconstruction, and he's in charge of all the money that's pouring in from America into Afghanistan. Here is an extract from an interview Shopko did a few days ago. This is what he said. Victory is when we can walk away and leave a government in place that can keep the terrorists out. That's the stated reason why we're there. We went into Afghanistan to kick the terrorists out and create a stable government that can keep terrorists out. Shopko is very optimistic about the future of Afghanistan, and he told Breitbart News, U.S. victory in the war-ravaged nation is achievable, but it may take time. But it may take time. Well, listen, Baya, don't waste your time, okay? Pack your bags and leave, because the Taliban is stronger than ever before. Samjhe? Listen to this, Malanis. 17 years ago, this is another report, 17 years ago, into the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, the Taliban insurgency is better armed than ever, fielding an ever-growing array of U.S.-made weapons and vehicles that they have procured, either looting them from Afghan forces or stealing them outright through the legendary levels of corruption in Afghanistan. This is, after all, the same country whose military has massive levels of desertion and where recruits regularly stick around for their first paycheck. Take that, they take the paycheck and the assault rifle that's issued to them, and then they vanish. That's a major problem for the U.S., which is used to having a major advantage in equipment and capabilities over their insurgent enemies, but increasingly are in up-armored Humvees fighting Taliban, who have exact same up-armored Humvees. This is a result of many years of losses, as hardly a single insider attack happens which doesn't end with the Taliban infiltrator clearing out the weapons and vehicles from a police or army checkpoint and disappearing into the countryside. Where the attacker goes, no one knows, but the weapons will be seen again and again on the battlefield. So, this is actually quite funny. U.S. troops, imagine U.S. troops in a Humvee, those big things that look like a tank, driving along a road outside of Kandahar, and they see another Humvee approaching them from the opposite side. And the Americans say, hey, it's our guys, now let's stop and have some coffee with them. And suddenly they wake up and actually smell the coffee. The Humvee is full of Talibans. The U.S. trained Afghan army is battling the Taliban, as also U.S. troops, but they are not winning at all. Here is what yesterday's article in the British Guardian newspaper said, Maulana. It says here, in Helmand province, which is markedly worse off than when foreign combat troops left 3 years ago, Afghan forces on the front line are desperate for support. But critics say that more military power only risks fomenting insurgency. Abdul Jabbar Kahraman, a former presidential envoy to Helmand, the Helmand province, said, even if you kill all the teenagers, the next generation will join the Taliban. The insurgency used to be mostly a business. Now it's also about revenge. Afghanistan is America's longest war, but it is a war America cannot win. And nowhere is this more evident than in Helmand. Places where British and American troops fought their hardest battles are now firmly under Taliban control. Babaji, the scene of one of the biggest British air assaults in modern times, fell to the Taliban shortly after the Guardian visited last year. Marja, which is in 2010, thousands of U.S., British, and Afghan troops launched the largest joint offensive in the war, is firmly in the control of the insurgents. In Musa Qala, the Taliban run a veritable government. In Lashkar Gah, they are close enough to occasionally lob rockets into the governor's compound. Haji Baz Gul, the first community leader to rise up against the Taliban in Marja in 2010, he's a mild-mannered elder with a cloud of gray hair and a gray beard and a white skull cap. Balgu said Western forces have left the Afghan allies in the lurch. He said, the enemy is at our gates, and the Taliban are not just winning the military battle, but hearts and minds too. And across Helmand, new mosques have cropped up. Keep cropping up, funded by private businessmen. Government schools, however, stand empty and decrepit. And Gul said, we have 2,000 Taliban madrasas in Helmand. The government is very weak. And Sarra Mohammed, another police commander who lost his legs to a mine 2 years ago, said, when there are American planes and helicopters monitoring in the air, nobody fires at us. When they are not there, we can't even move 1 meter without being shot at. So, dear listeners, I'll be sending an email to President Trump. Dear Donald Mamo, you told your generals about advice you got to build a bigger kitchen at your restaurant. Well, let me tell you this. Your troops can't stand the heat in the Afghanistan kitchen. Get them out very fast, okay?
Mm-hmm. What's the latest from Palestine, specifically Masjid al-Aqsa?
Well, I think Netanyahu is listening to our program every Friday. And so let me welcome him. Shalom, Habibi, shalom. I say this because when he put up those metal detectors at al-Aqsa, I said at that time that it was a silly move. Firstly, the Palestinians will not enter al-Aqsa until the detectors are removed and will pray outside in huge numbers, and that would create a constant pressure. Secondly, the Arab world will be more and more upset if this continued, and the Arab governments, who Netanyahu has built strong relationships with, would pull away from him under pressure from their citizens. And thirdly, this was just the first armed attack by Palestinians at al-Aqsa, so why go all overboard with security? These metal detectors don't serve much of a purpose. So remove them. And guess what? After he heard us on the Big Picture program, Maulana, he removed them. But you know what? Israelis are very upset at what happened. They're very, very, very upset. When the metal detectors were removed, the Palestinians were so happy. They celebrated all of this as a great victory, great victory. Israel had to back down. Israel was defeated. Israel was humiliated. That's how the Palestinians felt. And the scene was of jubilation. And this jubilation did not go down very well at all with the Israelis. If you remember, instead of just allowing the Palestinians in after the detectors were removed, the Israeli soldiers were firing rubber bullets and stun grenades into the crowds who were entering al-Aqsa. This was clearly an act of vindictiveness. They couldn't stomach it that the Palestinians had won. And as I said, Israelis are also deeply upset. Israel's Channel 2 TV station did a survey And the poll, which was broadcast on the 25th of July, showed that 77% of Israelis regarded the removal of the metal detectors as a surrender. And strong sentiments have been made by top government officials. For example, Likud politician Yehuda Glick, who is a prominent advocate for the rebuilding of the ancient temple at the site of Al-Aqsa, called on the government to stand by, what he says, the values of the people. He said, the war against us is behind those walls, meaning in the old city of Jerusalem, where Al-Aqsa is located. He said, the locals have a feeling of victory, and said, referring to the Palestinians, but it is temporary. He's talking about the Palestinians. God brought us to the land of Israel. We are strong and we will overcome all the difficulties in our path. And Eli Ben Dahan, a deputy minister for defense, called for the temple to be rebuilt, citing a portion of the Torah that talked about the renewal of the Jewish people. He said, this will only happen if we have full authority on Temple Mount, meaning Haram al-Sharif. Only when the temple is built will Jews be able to pray, he said. We'll be able to pray every hour and every day. No power in the world can stop the Jewish people, and we have to work to fulfill this vision. And the right-wingers are going to work very hard, Maulana, to show the Palestinians that their victory means nothing. They will go in greater numbers onto the grounds of Al-Aqsa. And according to the Jerusalem Post, on this Tuesday, this last Tuesday, 1,263 Jews went there between 7:30 a.m. and 11 a.m. on Tuesday. And this is a record for a single day. In this Jewish calendar year, 18,000 Jews went onto the Haram al-Sharif, that's the Al-Aqsa grounds, which again is a huge increase from the last year. And the Jerusalem Post says, there are, however, a significant number of national religious rabbis, including prominent arbiters of Jewish law, such as Rabbi Natam Rabinowitz and Dov Lior, who permits and encourages Jewish visitation to the holy site, and who last week called on Jews to visit the Temple Mount to strengthen our hold on this holy place. And there are others also, I don't want to read all of them. There's a guy called Asaf Fried, he's a spokesperson for a right-wing group. He says people are very angry. The government's behavior last week was humiliating and degrading, meaning giving in to the Palestinians. And Jordanian Foreign Minister Ayman Safadi said, one crisis has finished, but many more dangerous crises are likely to break out because of the ongoing violations by Israel. So Ish Netanyahu's plate is really full. Al-Aqsa is still in danger, and the right-wing demands put on him, on Netanyahu, and also he's facing an investigation of bribery. Apparently, he tried to get the biggest daily newspaper in Israel, Yediot Aharonot, to write favorable stories about him. It's all now hitting the fan, and maybe next week I'll tell you more about that, inshallah.
Inshallah. Uncle Abi, as always, jazakumullah for your time. Much appreciated, and we look forward to speaking to you all next week. But let's not forget the light at the end of the tunnel.
Ah, I thought that was the main part. Here's a quick question, Maulana. What's the difference between a good lawyer and a great lawyer? And the answer is, a good lawyer knows the law, and a great lawyer knows the judge. Have we got a minute for one more?
Yeah, bro.
Right. A man from Poland married a British girl after he had been in Britain for a year or so. And although his English was far from perfect, actually it was quite bad, the couple got on very well. One day, the Polish guy rushed into a lawyer's office and asked if he could arrange a divorce for him. Very quick, please, very quick. And the lawyer explained that the speed of getting a divorce would depend on the circumstances. And he asked the Polish guy these questions. Have you any grounds? And the Polish guy said, yes, an acre and a half and a nice three-bedroom house. And the lawyer said, no, I mean, what is the foundation of the case? And the Polish guy said, it is made of concrete and bricks and cement. And the lawyer said, does either of you have a grudge? And the Polish guy said, no, we have a carport and don't need a garage. And he said, I mean, what are your relations like? And he says, all my relations are in Poland. And he said, is there any infidelity in your marriage? And he says, yes, we have high fidelity stereo and DVD player and 6.1 sound. No. I mean, does your wife beat you up? And he says, no, I always up before her. Why do you want this divorce? And he says, she's going to kill me. What makes you think that? I got a proof. What kind of proof? She's going to poison me. I see a bottle on a dressing table. It says, Polish remover.
Uncle Abe, as always, Jazakumullah for your time. Much appreciated.
Always a pleasure, Maulana.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Don't forget, you've got to open a booth at the Central Station, Park Station in Joburg.
Look forward to it. Assalamu alaikum
wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.